11. It strikes me that nowadays people everywhere are trying to direct their gaze away from the real influence which Kant exercised on German philosophy, that is, cleverly to slip away from the value which he ascribed to himself. Above everything else, Kant was first and foremost proud of his table of categories. With this table in hand, he said, "That is the most difficult thing that ever could be undertaken on behalf of metaphysics. But people should understand this could be." He was proud of the fact that he had discovered a new faculty in human beings, the ability to make synthetic judgments a priori. Suppose that he deceived himself here. But the development and quick blood of German philosophy depend on this pride, and on the competition among all his followers to discover, if possible, something even prouder, at all events, new faculties. But let's think this over. It's time we did. How are synthetic judgments a priori possible? Kant asked himself. And what did his answer essentially amount to? Thanks to a faculty. However, unfortunately, he didn't answer in four words, but so laboriously, venerably, and with such an expenditure of German profundity and curlicues, that people failed to hear the comical niaiserie allemande, German stupidity, inherent in such an answer. People even got really excited about this new faculty, and the rejoicing reached its height when Kant discovered yet another additional faculty, a moral faculty, in human beings. For then the Germans were still moral, and not yet at all political realists. That was the honeymoon of German philosophy. All the young theologians of the Tübingen Seminary went off right away into the bushes, all looking for faculties. And what didn't they find in that innocent, rich, still youthful time of the German spirit, in which Romanticism, that malicious fairy, played her pipes and sang? A time when people did not yet know how to distinguish between finding and inventing. Above all, a faculty for the supersensory. Schelling christened this intellectual contemplation, and in so doing complied with the most heartfelt yearnings of his Germans, whose cravings were basically pious. The most unfair thing we can do to this entire rapturously enthusiastic movement, which was adolescent, no matter how much it boldly dressed itself up in grey and antique ideas, is to take it seriously and treat it with something like moral indignation. Enough. People grew older. The dream flew away. There came a time when people rubbed their foreheads. People are still rubbing them today. They had dreamed, first and foremost, the old Kant. By means of a faculty, he had said, or at least meant. But is that an answer, an explanation, or is it not rather a repetition of the question? How does opium make people sleep? By means of a faculty, namely the virtus dormitiva, sleeping virtue, answered that doctor in Molière. Because it has the sleeping virtue whose nature makes the senses sleep. But answers like that belong in comedy, and the time has finally come to replace the Kantian question, how are synthetic judgments a priori possible, with another question. Why is the belief in such judgments necessary? That is, to understand that for the purposes of preserving beings of our type, we must believe that such judgments are true, although, of course, they could still be false judgments. Or to speak more clearly, crudely, and fundamentally, synthetic judgments a priori should not be possible at all. We have no right to them. In our mouths, they are nothing but false judgments. Of course, it's true that a belief in their truth is necessary as a foreground belief and appearance which belong in the perspective optics of living. In order, finally, to recall the immense influence which German philosophy, you understand, I hope it's right to quotation marks, has exercised throughout Europe, there should be no doubt that a certain virtus dormitiva, virtue of making people sleep, was a part of that. People, among them noble loafers, the virtuous, the mystics, artists, three-quarter Christians, and political obscurantists of all nations, were delighted to have, thanks to German philosophy, an antidote to the still overpowering sensuality which flowed over from the previous century into this one. In short, to have a sensus assoupire, way of putting the senses to sleep. 12. So far as the materialistic atomism is concerned, it belongs with the most effectively refuted things we have, and perhaps nowadays in Europe no scholar remains so unscholarly that he still ascribes a serious meaning to it, other than for convenient hand and household use, that is, as an abbreviated way of expressing oneself, thanks primarily to that Pole Boscovich, who, together with the Pole Copernicus, has so far been the greatest and most victorious opponent of appearances. For while Copernicus convinced us to believe, contrary to all our senses, that the earth did not stand still, Boscovich taught us to renounce the belief in the final thing which made the earth stand firm, the belief in stuff, in material, in what was left of the earth, in atomic particles. It was the greatest triumph over the senses which has ever been achieved on earth so far. But we must go even further and also declare war, a relentless war to the bitter end, against the atomistic need, which still constantly carries on in a dangerous afterlife in places where no one suspects, like that celebrated metaphysical need. We must at the start also get rid of that other and more disastrous atomism which Christianity has taught best and longest, the atomism of the soul. With this phrase, let me be permitted to designate the belief which assumes that the soul is something indestructible, eternal, indivisible, like a monad, like an atomon. We should rid scientific knowledge of this belief. Just between us, it is not absolutely necessary to get rid of the soul itself and to renounce one of the oldest and most venerable hypotheses, as habitually happens with the clumsiness of the naturalists, who hardly touch upon the soul without losing it. But the way to new versions and refinements of the hypothesis of the soul stands open, and ideas like mortal soul, and soul as the multiplicity of the subject, and soul as the social structure of drives and emotional effects, from now on want to have civil rights in scientific knowledge. While the new psychologist is preparing an end to superstition, which so far has flourished with an almost tropical lushness in the way the soul has been imagined, at the same time he has naturally pushed himself, as it were, into a new desert and a new mistrust. It may be the case that the older psychologists had a more comfortable and happier time. Finally, however, he knows that in that very process he himself is condemned to invent things, and, who knows, perhaps to discover something.